Hello, and welcome to the second Blackbird Review podcast. This podcast includes two short stories written by high school students and an excerpt from an interview with a resident mystery English teacher. We'll give you a hint, it's not Mr. Stumbaugh, and their name begins with Mrs. and ends with Levy. We hope you'll enjoy these following selections.
And now we have Lindsay Odorisi's car conversation story.
I pull my cheek from the frosted glass, my eyes still sealed shut from sleep. I feel the car come to a stop, the rumbling of the engine almost lulling me back into my already forgotten dream. I resist the urge to fall back asleep and force my eyes open a crack. The red lights on the backs of the cars blink at me as I try to separate reality from my dreams. My eyes get more adjusted to the dark, and I try to take in more of my surroundings, my mind still clouded with exhaustion. I pull the sleeves of my ratty sweatshirt down over my hands, suddenly noticing the cold. Heat is blasting through the tiny air vent set into the dashboard, but it's not enough to warm the chill in the air. Someone draws in a breath, and I whip my head to the left to find a boy sitting in the driver's seat. I scan his face, shadows being cast over his features by the lights from the road. Dark hair, small nose, sharp jawline. Reed, I didn't mean to say his name out loud. He looks over at me for a second, then his eyes glue themselves back to the road. A smile tugs at his chapped lips as the light turns green and the car starts to move again. I sit up a bit more and run my fingers through my tangled hair. How'd you sleep? He says it in that tone you only use when it's 3 a.m. and you're still awake at a sleepover. It's one of the most calming things I've ever heard, especially when it comes out of his mouth. I take a deep breath as I think about my response. Good, I think. My voice scratches against the space between us. I clear my throat but say nothing more. His eyes flick over to me, then back to the road. I wish I could see his face better. I notice the wall up around him, meant to separate us and keep me away, despite the smile still on his face. I desperately try to remember all the details from only a few hours ago. We sit in silence for a few miles, an indie song whispering through the radio. Reed, about tonight, I start, but he cuts me off with a perfectly timed coughing. I press my face against the window in defeat, welcoming the cold onto my skin. I glance over at the dashboard. The clock reads 1:48 a.m. I sigh and place my chin on my fist, my cheeks still numb from the glass. I stare out the window, but there's nothing much to see. Dark silhouettes of the many pine trees lining the highway barely stand out from the blackness. I see Reed's reflection in the glass and make a game out of shifting my focus between him and the shadows outside the car. I'm surprised when Reed breaks the silence first. I know what you're going to say, but I don't want any of it right now. I look over at him and open my mouth to speak, but he cuts me off with a glance in my direction. It's just that, I mean, what you said at the party, his voice breaks, did you mean it? I stare at his profile, framed by the artificial light coming in through the window. The smile that was on his face before is gone. If I wasn't fully awake before, I am now, and I clearly hear the poorly concealed hurt in his voice, and the tears collecting in his eyes are threatening to fall. Against my will, I recall the party we had left only a few hours ago. The smell of alcohol and smoke float through the stuffy rooms, the sweaty bodies lined up next to each other, covering every square inch of the floor. It's loud and quiet at the same time. Light and dark have blended together, and I see Reed next to me on a couch. I barely register what he's saying, and words are being extracted from my mouth by hidden forces I have no control over. I don't remember what I said, or what he said, but I remember how I felt, and I have a pretty good idea how he must have felt. I feel my own tears making their way to the corner of my eyes, but I decided to play it safe. No, Reed, God, no, of course I didn't mean it. I was just, I don't know, I was upset and what, he asked. I can't tell if he's angry or just curious. What I do next shocks both of us. Maybe it's because I'm tired or still hung up about what happened at the party or just a bunch of things stacked up on top of each other. But I snap. Do you know what your problem is, Reed? You can't take a joke. Why does everything have to be serious for you? Why can't you lighten up a little? My voice starts to rise, disturbing the once cold and peaceful air in the car. What I said at the party? A total joke. You know, I didn't mean any of it, so why are you still talking about it? I was cold before, but now the steaming hot blood is pounding in my ears and I'm buzzing with energy that shouldn't be there. Reed looks at me longer this time, enough time for me to see his pale blue eyes glistening with tears. I have known those eyes since kindergarten. I remember the first time I saw them, just like this, tears ready to stain his face. except we were on a rickety old playground and his tears were for something almost meaningless. I can't remember what. But I do remember sitting down next to those eyes, just sitting, nothing said, nothing done, just sitting. We've been friends ever since. Now I look at his eyes and I realize how much older they are, how much more they've seen of the world. But I also see how much more they have to experience in the years to come, how much more they have yet to learn. And these tears now mean so much more than they did all those years ago. They hold such depth. My heartbeat slows, the buzzing ceases, the little heater by my knee melts my heart, and I see how much of an idiot I am. I find his eyes once again. Reed, and then the oddest thing happens. I avert my eyes from his, unable to bear the weight of them, and look at the road, seeing as that it's the only thing I can look at. I stare for a moment. I don't fully comprehend what's happening until it does. Natalie, Reed screams. His hand tugs the steering wheel, knuckles white. The tires squeal against the asphalt. The lights are blinding, but I see the tears paint invisible lines down his cheeks, and the blue eyes connect with mine before everything stops.
Here we present Sarah Gannon's My Sky.
Stars in the sky write to me. They send me letters every now and then. On paper is where their words won't be, but in my heart, time and time again. The country stars seem to shout secrets that have been locked away. I'm the only one who lets them out, but maybe someone else will another day. City stars whisper each word, stories of virtue and greed. They can barely be heard, just as they can barely be seen. Stars that blanket the sea sing me a sweet song, one that cries a silent plea, begging to live on. The North Pole stars, way up high, send me all their questions. Not one is the same, like the snowflakes that float by, all they're looking for is some suggestions. My favorites by far must be the ones above my home. They are always sending me advice. Every day they write me because they know. Sometimes I just need something sweet and nice.
And now we have the well-awaited Mrs. Levy interview, where we ask about Mrs. Levy's life and her literary experiences.
We know that you've published Writing College in English and Real Kids Don't Say Please. And one of them is obviously a college textbook, but what, can you tell us a little about the other one?
Yeah, it was a humor book. And I got the idea when we were writing to New York, my husband and I, with Morris, my oldest son, who was a baby at the time, like 9 months old, in the back seat. And somebody was talking about their new book. Somebody said that his new book was Real Men Don't Eat Quiche. Later there was another one that came out, Real Women Don't Pump Gas. But I said, oh, it's like Real Babies Don't, and I don't even remember what I said, and I came up with a few jokes about real babies. And then later, Dan, my husband, said, it's too little with real babies. Real kids would be a good line. I came up with Real Kids Don't Say Please, and then I went with that idea, and I had, it was funny. It was a good humor book. Actually, my best friend, well, one of our best friends, Marco, not Rubio, but David Markowitz read it, and he said, it's really good. It's not funny, but it's really good. But it was a humor book.
Okay. When you were in high school, would you have expected to be where you are today, like as a
teaching?
Writer and teacher?
No. Even when I was in college and graduate school, I wouldn't have expected myself to be in a high school. I used to think that I wanted to teach, but I liked the idea of teaching nursery school or college. I didn't really want to have anything to do with anybody in between. I actually applied in college to school, to Bank Street School of Education, got in to teach early childhood education. I love little kids. One of my writing teachers said, why would you want to go there? And I did begin to wonder whether it was really the right place for me. And I eventually, when I was ready to go on, when I had graduated from my undergraduate program, I had to choose between going on to a program in English or going to Bank Street, and I chose to go on in English. I really love doing research on English topics. I love medieval literature, Renaissance literature particularly. And when I had done that for a while, I really did consider college teaching. I did some college teaching, and I enjoyed it. But it's hard. Being a college teacher, you do have to publish all the time. It's much more than teaching. And I had begun to find that the thing I really loved wasn't the research, but it was the teaching. I loved working with students. I then went on and took some Spanish teaching courses. I knew how to speak Spanish by that time. And because I knew it would be easier to get jobs teaching Spanish than teaching English, an oversubscribed field. And when I first taught here, I had already taught at the Hebrew Academy. I started teaching Spanish there. Then I taught English as well. And when I came here, I was signed on basically as a Spanish teacher. But I kind of asked at the interview, if there are any English courses you need taught, I'd like to do that. I love teaching high school. I think I like it a lot better than I like teaching college, just because you get to know the students better. And much to my surprise, because when I was in high school, I didn't like a whole lot of high school students, but I really love most of my students. So, yeah, so that's why. So I'm delighted to be doing what I'm doing.
So is there any advice you would give to your younger self, or anything you would change if you could go back and redo
it? Let's not even go there. Yes, there are many things, specific places I wouldn't have gone to.
Pertaining to your writing.
Both literal and figurative. I still have a lot of writing that I did not, I didn't pursue with publication for. I used to write children's books a lot. At first it was kind of just for myself, but at a certain point I really did think, I'd like to publish these things. It came down to this one day. I had an agent. I had sent my stuff. You have to go through an agent. So I sent my stuff to an agent, and she was very interested in my work. And she wanted to meet me in New York, but I'm a mom and I had kids. So do I regret not having met her? Well, maybe a little tiny bit, but at the time I was being a mom, and that was really what I wanted to do. So I'm not really regretful, but it was a missed opportunity, I think. There were probably other missed opportunities along the way. I had an opportunity to teach regularly at SUNY, but it again meant that I would have to be at SUNY when my kids were coming home from school, and I really didn't want to do that. So I took a lot of years off to be a mom, and even when high school teaching is great because you're pretty much out when your kids are out, and even if you have to work at home, you're there with your kids, you can answer questions and talk to them and stuff. So that was really important to me.
So you've been talking a lot about teaching. Did you ever make a conscious decision to be a writer? Like, did that go along with the teaching?
I actually probably thought that I might be a writer. And of course, you can be a writer and be many other things, a waiter or, an insurance salesman. I mean, famous writers have had jobs like that. I was a writing major as an undergraduate at college, and I did submit some stuff to journals. I was not good on the follow-through. I had some good feedback, people interested. There was a story I wrote called Witch. It was about my mom. And in the story, I killed her at the end. And I was told that matricide was really a very extreme thing to include in the story, and could I tone it down? But I liked the story. I'm like Bernie. I wanted to be true to the story, and so I didn't want to change it. Again, probably that was might have been a missed opportunity as well. It was a big journal at the time that wanted it. So I probably missed some opportunities that way, but I have to say that from the moment I first taught, I just realized I love teaching, and I still do. I get a great kick out of it. I think it's very meaningful, and I don't think I would have been happier not having done that and having tried my hand more ardently at being a writer, I think I'm doing what really makes me happy.
Okay. Do you still write today?
Not a lot. Well, comments on students' papers.
Yeah, that's a lot of writing.
Yeah, that's a lot of writing.
Research paper.
Yeah. But no, I don't. And sometimes I think about it. I'm very careful about crafting emails. I really am. And I still love writing. I don't know. I sometimes wonder because, you know, I'm getting old. I'm getting to the point where it won't be that many years that I will be able, I think, to keep teaching. And I do wonder, will I retire and start to write a lot again? Because I used to write a lot. And every now and then I take out my folder of, you know, old material and I think about it, but I haven't had the energy to do it yet. So we'll see what happens after I retire. I hope there's a lot of years left.
I know you're an English teacher, but do you have any general tips on what to do and what not to do when it comes to writing?
I still remember from seventh grade a story that I wrote. We were supposed to write, it was like a little play or something. It had to have dialogue. And I wrote a story that I called, I don't know, Susan Damon and Wanda Pythias or something. It was about, I don't know if you know the story of Damon and Pythias, and one sort of substitutes for the other to avoid, you know, so that he can go home and say goodbye to his family, and he's in danger of being killed, but his friend comes back. And anyway, that story that I wrote featured a boa constrictor, and it was a little far-fetched. And my teacher wrote on it that, you know, it's better to write about stuff that you really know. And I took it home, and I was devastated because I was the poet laureate of the sixth grade. I was, you know, this wonderful, gifted writer. And my mother talked to me about it, and she, you know, we talked, and she said, yeah, he's right. You know, it really is better. So I wrote another dialogue that was my mother and me talking, okay? It was just our, the same conversation that we'd had. And I handed that in, and I got a good grade. And I think I learned a lesson that writing about what you know is much better than writing about something far-fetched. I mean, you can write about fantasy stuff, but if there's not some germ of it that's from your own life, from your own experience, that's what makes Tolkien so great, except for the elf language. I mean, Tolkien writes about fantastic creatures, but they are perfectly recognizable, you know, as for with their human feelings and human actions. And I think that is what makes some writers just better than others, that they are writing about something that's very real because they have that, because they're really in touch with their own emotions, with their own experience, because they're writing out of their experience.
What is the hardest thing about writing for you?
You know, sitting down to do it. It's a very lonely enterprise. I remember a professor talking to me about, talking to the class actually in graduate school, about another kind of writing, which is, you know, research writing and scholarly writing and critical writing, which I did a lot of in graduate school and before. And he talked about this one very prominent critic, a writer of that kind of stuff, critical literature, who had a technique. He would go to the Carroll in the library and he'd line up candy bars, and he had to write so many pages before he could have the first candy bar, and he'd go through the candy bars and so managed to do the writing that he had to do during the day. It is a very hard, I think that's the hardest thing, just sitting down to the task. The ideas are often there, but it's very hard, and you are pulling something out of yourself. You're not really, at the moment, communicating with anyone. I'm a real, you know, reviser, so I will read over everything and carefully revise each time, and it's just hard to pull yourself away from real life to do that, but it's really necessary to do. I'm looking forward to that. I might do that again. Yes.
Who's your favorite author?
Ooh. My favorite poet is Robert Browning. I memorized a, you know, 7-page poem by Robert Browning just because I'd read it so often, Andrea del Sarto.
I was going to ask you to recite it, but then you said 7 pages.
Yeah, it'll take a while. And now I sometimes need a little correction. But at the time, I didn't even mean to memorize it. I just read it so many times to myself, aloud mostly, that suddenly I realized I didn't need to look at the book. I just had it. Obviously, Shakespeare is fabulous, and I took a lot of coursework in Shakespeare. I love Chaucer. I can't share it with that many people because of the Middle English, but I love Chaucer. Of modern writers, I love Twain. I think Huckleberry Finn is the great American novel. I just saw the film version yesterday again of Billy Budd. Billy Budd's a great story. Melville's a great writer. And I love the books I teach. I love Dickens. I love Emily Bronte. Jane Austen's pretty good, too. A lot of good writers out there. Yeah.
What's your favorite thing about writing?
I think it's words that so appeal to me. Having the precise word for something, capturing in precise words exactly what I want to say. And when I write emails, I'm not kidding. I mean, I'll go over them, I'll change the words, I'll look up words to make sure that I'm using exactly the word that I want to use. I'm talking about emails to my kids. I do this regularly, so finding just the right words to articulate something is something that's very meaningful to me and always was. I love words.
What is your favorite thing about teaching English?
There are a lot of things. I don't think I have one favorite. It's a great pleasure and a thrill to be able to teach texts that you think are great and to look at them again and read them again and realize again and share with others, you know, what's so great about them. You know, we looked at an AP task today in AP English, a little excerpt from the novel McTeague, and it's so well written. Every detail, the kids hadn't understood it. Most of the kids had thought one thing about the text, it the opposite. They missed the irony. I love irony. And it's just wonderful to look at a piece of writing and see how beautifully crafted it is. I mean, it's like looking at any piece of art or piece of furniture or a beautiful meal that's just perfectly crafted and you appreciate every little detail of it. That's what I love about it.
What do you think makes a story good? Like, the most important quality? I know you already just talked about, like, experience, but is there anything else?
Well, I think that last word, detail, we're just reading Fahrenheit 451 again. There's that little place. That's not a great novel. But there's that one part in Fahrenheit 451 where Bradbury has Faber talking about the detail that used to go into older things that's no longer a part of what he sees around himself. We're going back to the 1950s, but in television and in movies, he's feeling like all of that is not as good as it used to be. It doesn't have all of the texture, all of the details. I don't think that it's true that that's disappeared from things where it's not... We're not living in that world. But that is what I appreciate. And it's what I appreciate, I think, in almost anything. You look at a painting that you really love, and yes, the whole painting affects you, but there are little, you know, you look at one thing and another little piece of it, and you appreciate something that the artist is saying with that painting. And it's the same with literature. So detail is very important. That's why I test you guys so cruelly on the text that we read, because it is by the detail that you understand what's happening in a text, and it's through the detail that the writer makes you his puppet, makes you feel what he wants you to feel, makes you experience what he has experienced or wants you to. Yeah?
Is there any advice or just any information you want to, like, leave with the people who are listening?
I'm not dying yet.
Well, like,
wait a minute.
No, like, for the end of the
last will
and testament. Yeah. Like, for, like, aspiring writers.
I guess, you know, just to keep at it. I say that with some reservation because there are times when you realize something else is actually more important and to you, that you're better at it, that it's more important to you or to the world. So, and I, as I said, writing is not easy. It's hard. But I do think that that anything that you do well takes real effort. And so if you're a writer, you can't, I believe, you can't do it casually. You have to really commit to it. Commit time, commit effort, commit thought, commit energy, commit to the awful feeling of having stuff marked up and rejected, or just you read it again, you say, what the heck did I, why did I write this? And knowing you have to take it apart again. So being willing to experience those very hard moments and go on. And that's not just for writers. That's for pretty much anything that you want to do well. That stuff is... Persistence like that is necessary. Tell that to Marco Rubio. That might help. Yes.
Okay, that's it.
All right.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it.
And that's it for another episode of the Blackbird Review podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. The Blackbird Review podcast is a production of the Blackbird Review and the Voorheesville Central School District. It is produced by Clarence Chen and Sarah Alden. And in this episode included the vocal talents of Sarah Gannon, Madison Canfora, and Maya Herr. Our intro music was written and performed by Sadie Goldfarb and Sophia Galati. All of the stories heard on the podcast and so much more can be found on our website, www.blackbirdreview.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.